The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to What About Wealth? Making it, investing it, protecting it, leaving a legacy with your hosts, Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. In today's economy, preserving wealth has become more important than ever, especially when it comes to our future generations. Now, here is Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee.
Good morning, good morning. This is Rick Durfee from sunny Arizona, where we had a freeze last night. And my co-host, Rich Bloomfield, is in snowy Utah, and the snow must be deep and thick because we haven't heard from him yet this morning. So we'll give him an excused absence, but he may join us before we're done with the show. We're excited about our program today. It is Fun with the Family Bank. The Family Bank is a vital component, a very important part of an integrated estate and business plan. And understanding how it works and why we have it and what it does is critical, but it's also somewhat confusing and somewhat tough to figure out. Just this last week, in fact, I met with a client with a substantial net worth, hundreds of millions of dollars, actually, and a bright guy, a brilliant guy who could start with nothing and make a boatload of money and very, very smart, and yet taking the time to look at and figure out how does this thing work? Why do I have it? What's its purpose? How do I use it to my best advantage is challenging and tough. So in our program today, we're going to talk through the Family Bank, what it is, why we have it, how it works, how you set it up, how it's different from other entities, how it's taxed, where we set it up, who owns it, who controls it, and how we operate it and implement it and use it, and what are some of the landmines and dangerous things to avoid. So right off the bat, what the heck is the Family Bank in an integrated structure? And it is a separate entity. Typically, it's either a master limited partnership or a limited liability company, and it will own or hold the equity in all of the family assets. And it's critical that to be structured properly, and we'll unpack this some, that the Family Bank is never owned by natural persons. Rather, it is a partnership between and owned by both the revocable family trust and what we call the irrevocable family dynasty trust, and we'll unpack that and talk about what that means. Optimally, it is controlled by a management company that's either the manager, if this entity is an LLC, or the general partner, if this entity is a limited partnership. And it holds dangerous or risky properties or assets in subsidiary entities. It owns all the bank accounts and investments, and it protects and preserves the family wealth and finances the family's various enterprises and businesses. So right off the bat then, that's our general definition, and I know there's a lot of words in there, and that can be somewhat daunting, but let's unpack this. Let's first look at what is the purpose of the Family Bank, and it has multiple purposes, layers of purposes. And the first purpose right off the bat is it has non-tax, non-asset protection business purposes. It must have a business purpose. And that overwhelms some people sometimes. Oh, I don't have a business. Well, you will have a business by the time you have a family bank set up. It is going to be a business entity with a business purpose. And if nothing else, its business purpose is to carry out some of the other purposes that we're going to talk about here. The next purpose is it's a tax planning entity. We can manage what party pays the taxes and where the tax responsibility flows, so we can manage the tax consequences. We can't make them go away, and you're going to pay taxes, but we can use this family bank entity to manage the ultimate tax liability. Then, of course, a huge, huge purpose, and a completely legitimate purpose, even though this scares some people, is asset protection. The family bank's purpose, among other things, is to exclude risk. We want to keep the risk away from the good stuff. So we keep the risk on the outside, and we put the good things that we want to protect on the inside, which means, by the way, that we don't throw dangerous stuff in the mix with the good stuff that we're trying to protect. So we wrap dangerous stuff in their own subsidiary LLCs, and we'll talk about that. Then purpose number four, as we're going down our list here, is estate planning. The family bank is a very powerful device for structuring wealth so that it is not taxed when a person dies, so that it stays in the family. And then a kind of a related purpose to the estate planning is succession planning, so that assets move from one generation to the next, or from one series of owners to the next, smoothly, efficiently, without conflict, without litigation, without adverse tax consequences. That's a huge purpose, and we will talk through this, how it works. And then, of course, another significant purpose of the family bank is to manage who has control over and access to the assets that it holds. Obviously, the client, me if it's me, or you if it's you, wants to be in control of the stuff, of the good stuff that we have in the family bank, but we don't want to give control to the bad guys, to the predatory plaintiffs that have sued us, or to the opportunistic litigants that are trying to get a piece of our action. We want to exclude them from control, and we want to preserve control in the right people. And then, of course, that also fits into the succession issues. We want to manage who's going to be in control when one person or one generation over time loses the ability to have control because of age or accident or illness. So we're going to manage that control issue. Then another significant aspect of the family bank is we facilitate multi-party ownership. So mommy and daddy and the kids and the grandkids can all own a piece of this business entity and share in the benefits from that, instead of just having one person own it. And that multi-party ownership kind of tags into yet another purpose, which is to facilitate group purchasing power. Very often a family coming together as a group can pool their resources and buy more or invest in more together than they could separately. So the family as a group could buy a bigger property, could qualify to participate in a larger investment pool. There are a number of investment and financial products that are only available to if you have enough money to get in the door, so that you're an accredited investor, so to speak. And you can't do that sometimes if you're acting alone, but you can do it working together. And then the final purpose that we'll mention here of the family bank is to hold equity separate from where we place control. And this kind of is a tough concept for some people to understand, but once you get it, it's just makes sense. We want to place control and equity and risk in separate buckets. We want to keep those separate from each other. And the family bank is the equity bucket. This is where we put the stuff that's valuable. Okay, so with all of these business purposes, what is the theory or the legal doctrine behind the family bank? And this kind of plays into the nature of the entity that we use for the family bank. It's going to be either a limited partnership or a limited liability company. And that word limited is a very, very significant. That's where we separate the risk from the ownership. That's the piece where if we do it properly, we keep the risk on the outside so that the equity on the inside is protected. And that's excluding the risk. And then we'll talk about containing the risk where we hold the risk on the inside and we don't let it get out to the outside. But for the most part, this family bank, its purpose is to exclude risk. And there's a number of legal doctrines that this is based upon. One of them is that you cannot compel people to be partners. So if you and your partners have a deal and I come in as the predatory litigator and I'm suing you, I cannot take your ownership interest in the partnership away from you because that would result in me becoming a partner with your partner. And that's called mutuality of contract. If you don't have a deal, if you haven't made a contract with each other, the courts or the state cannot arbitrarily say, well, you have to contract with this person. Now, candidly, this whole idea is in flux. It has been a well-established legal doctrine for hundreds of years, but what we're seeing in our current political environment situations where the state is asserting the power or the right to compel people to make purchases, which could be a slippery slope that could take us down the path of seeing the state then compel people to become partners. But at the moment, at least, without mutuality of contract, people cannot be compelled to be partners. So that makes it so that the exclusive remedy of creditors who might be pursuing a partner or an owner in this family bank, their exclusive remedy is the charging lien or the charging order. And we're not going to talk about this in detail, but I want to mention it in passing. It means that the creditor stands in the shoes of that partner and receives whatever benefits, whatever income, quote unquote, is going to flow out of that partnership to that member or that partner will instead go to the creditor. Now, it's important to remember for asset protection purposes and for tax planning purposes that income is a tax liability. If you have income, you pay taxes, even if you don't get cash flow, and you can have income independent of cash flow. So that charging lien or charging order that the creditor is entitled to can be an unpleasant event. They can get phantom income passed out to them. So that's part of the theory that goes into this. Again, the whole idea is to separate risk and control and equity from each other and hold them into separate banks. And the family bank is the equity bucket. Now, for this to work, this is, again, part of the theory, there must be more than one partner or member, and we're going to talk about who those should be. We'll mention here, as we will mention again, that they should not be natural persons. And, of course, we can manipulate then where the control is located. So based on these theories, and that some of that might be a little esoteric for our listeners, I apologize for that, but we have to go through that so that you can understand all the other stuff that comes next. How do you form this family bank? The family bank is a legal entity that is formed under a local state charter. So it is usually registered or filed with a state regulatory agency, and this varies from state to state. In some states, they will have a corporation commission, which is where they will be filed. Other states will file these entities with the Secretary of State. And some states, it's online and very simple and easy. Other states, it's more complicated and interesting to do. The governing documents of the entity are also necessary, but interestingly enough, they are private and not filed with the state, which is a tricky thing that sometimes confuses people and causes them to think that because the documents are not filed with the state that they are not necessary, but that is not true. To have the family bank be fully functional and to complete all of the purposes that we listed a few minutes ago, that family bank must be adequately documented, and this includes For example, having an operating agreement if you're an LLC or a partnership agreement if you are a limited partnership. And those agreements will manage and set forth the rules that handle the management, the control, the taxation, the ability to exclude or admit new partners or members. It will manage restrictions on transferability, which is part of how we keep out the bad guys. It will determine the control and succession issues so that we know what's going to happen with this entity over time. All of that is managed in the operating agreement. And those are particularly critical in today's world where you can elect how the entity is going to be taxed. Is it going to be taxed as a partnership or as a corporation? Those kind of issues, in addition to checking the box on a form you file with the IRS, those kind of issues are managed in the governing, operating, or partnership agreements of the family bank. And then, of course, there needs to be evidence of ownership. So the members or the partners will have some kind of a certificate that demonstrates that they own the interest. And that's also a vital tool in excluding the hostile parties, keeping the bad guys out. And then this entity is, for federal purposes and state purposes, a taxable entity or a tax. It has a tax ID as the bottom line. Now we'll talk about its tax status in a minute here, but it does have to file tax returns. It will have a tax ID number. And that's part of what makes it a separate standalone entity. And then, of course, a critical aspect of the formation as well as the maintenance are the accounting and tax records. The family bank has to maintain records of its accounts, of its assets. It should have a balance sheet. It must file tax returns every year that put all these things in place. So the entity of the family bank is formed by registering it with the state, setting up all those ancillary support documents, obtaining a tax ID number, and then setting up the accounting and the tax records. Now, in the last few minutes here before we go to break, we often get the question, well, what's best? Is it best to use a limited partnership or a limited liability company? And frankly, we've used both, and we sometimes go back and forth, and we'll use one in one instance and another in a different instance. And how do we know which one to use, which one is best? Let me say that historically, the limited partnership has been used the longest and has been around the longest. It has the longest track record. We have a lot of court cases, a lot of case law that define the rules. It's very well established also legislatively in the statutes. So for a long, long time, the limited partnership has been the favored entity and the one that we use the most. But in recent years, the LLC has become increasingly popular, and there are a couple of reasons, the big one being that the LLC has no general partner that has general liability. With a limited partnership, there's two kinds of partners, a limited partner and a general partner. The limited partner has equity but no control and no risk. The general partner has equity and control and risk. So that's something we have to manage and control with a limited partnership that we just don't have to deal with the LLC, because the LLC has no general partner. Instead, it has managers. And we'll talk about whether they should be manager-managed or member-managed. And I'll just say here they should always be manager-managed. And the bottom line is this comes down to it's state-dependent. Each state has its own rules. So it's going to depend on where the client is domiciled, what state they live in, where they're operating in, what kind of assets they're holding. So there are situations where we will prefer the limited partnership to the LLC, and other situations where the LLC will be better. So there's no one-size-fits-all answer here. That's an answer or a question that needs to be addressed with guidance from professional advisors as this is being set up. We're going to have to go to break here. When we come back from break, we'll talk about how these entities are taxed, how the family bank entity is taxed. And I predict that when we come back from break, my co-host Rich Bloomfield will be joining us. So we'll hit that when we come back from our break.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Rich Bloomfield, and I'm the CPA.
And this is Rick Durfee. I'm the lawyer, and I'm grateful that we have a co-host for the second part of our show today.
And I'm grateful to be here. So our topic this hour is Fun with the Family Bank. And Rick has been doing a great job presenting as a solo host for the first section here. And I'm glad to be joining in for this next these next two sections. So Rick, I guess before we went to break, we were talking about a lot of things, but we were going to talk about how the family bank is taxed in this next section. So since I do all this taxation stuff, maybe I should talk about this.
Ivan, tell me how this is taxed. I know it has to file a tax return, but then it doesn't pay taxes, which is a mystical event for some people. So explain that to us.
All right. So it doesn't matter here whether you end up being an LLC or whether it's a limited partnership that we set up for you. And as Rick explained in the last section, that depends on a number of things. But today it seems like we set up a lot more LLCs than limited partnerships because of the general partner thing. But in any event, either one of them has to file a return. The return that they file is a 1065, or what's always been known as a partnership return. So even though you're an LLC, you'd still file a partnership return. And the 1065 is what any entity that files a 1065 is known as a flow-through entity for tax treatment. So in other words, we file the return, we disclose all the activity and what we do inside of the return is we break up all the activity of the return and we parcel it out to the various partners or members, depending on whether it's a partnership or an LLC. And the way you show each partner or member what their activity is that they need to pick up on their personal return is by giving them a K-1. And so it's a 1065 K-1. So it's an attachment or another ancillary form that's filed with the 1065. And so on these K-1s, we show them, so if we had $1 million that came through in income and 10 partners, then 100,000 would be reported on each K-1 if they owned it equally, 10% each. But there are many entities out there that own it in different ways. And when we have a family bank, it's typically owned in very different ways. And so it would have at least two members or partners, but they would have typically have very different sharing ratios. So the other thing that is shown on the K-1 is the capital account, your capital account. So in other words, what a capital account is in a partnership is that when a partnership or an LLC is formed, then each partner typically will put in some money to start the venture. And so that would go into their capital account. So if they each put in $1,000, or if one of them put in $500, another put in $1,000, then that would go in their capital account, and then that would be, they would be assigned a percentage of the ownership, and you end up being assigned actually an ownership in three things: the profits, the losses, and the capital. And so, and those can all be different, by the way, but they're most often they're the same. So, so that's what ends up on the K-1, and so you get that every year, and then you need to you'll have to report the income or loss that comes through on the K-1, and then your capital accounts are important because you have to track your basis, which means, you know, your tax basis in the partnership. If you don't have anything at risk or any money in the venture, then it's you know, sometimes it's difficult to be able to take losses if you don't have basis. So now the other thing is that you have Rick talked earlier about having a general partner or another third party entity as the manager. In an LLC, you can have a manager who's actually controlling the whole entity, but wouldn't end up with a K-1 because they don't own anything. A general partner, on the other hand, would get a K-1 because they have to own something, and often that's a very small interest, but they would get a K-1 because they would own a percentage or a half a percent, whatever it ends up being. But they would have to report that. Whereas a third-party manager doesn't have anything to report on the tax return. They're just the manager. And as far as records are concerned, these tax records are the tax returns, K-1s, are all part of the business records, and are typically kept by the manager. K-1s are sent to all the members and partners. And sometimes we send them complete copies of the returns, but very often they just get a K-1 unless they need it for some other reason.
You know, so, I want to mention something about that, Rich. In years gone by, way back, this betrays my age, how long I've been practicing, but with limited partnerships years ago, every year we had to amend them with the Secretary of State to reflect the new percentages resulting from the tax returns. And some time ago, in fact, a couple of decades ago, they changed the rules to say, if you have reported this on your tax returns, you do not have to do a filing at the state, which on the one hand saved the client and the state a lot of paperwork, but sadly, on the other hand, reduced the amount of legal fees that can be charged every year by the lawyer. So it used to be that the lawyers had an annuity similar to the CPA's tax return that we had to do something every year, but then they took that away from us.
Well, it's a good thing they did. So. No, but you bring up a good point, Rick, because you and I both find that it gets very confusing sometimes when we look at new clients, and when they haven't had to do that, then you know, sometimes it becomes very confusing as to what the actual ownership percentages are, because even on the tax returns, sometimes they're not reported correctly. And so I don't know. I think that probably kept things a lot more in line where they should be. But it was a lot of paperwork.
Yeah, it made it so the lawyers every year would be asking the tax people, hey, what are the capital accounts? What are the resulting percentages? Because I have to file a document. And right. Now we don't have to do that, so that interchange is kind of reduced. A lot of times the lawyers are clueless. We don't see the tax returns. We don't get them. They happen independent from us, and which is part of the reason, again, why you and I work together and why that's a benefit to the client. When the tax reporting and the legal documentation are coordinated and collaborated together, the client ends up with a better outcome.
That's for sure. So, Rick, let's talk about where we set these things up. So what's the best state in which to set up the family bank entity?
You know, we get that question a lot, and part of that's because we have clients all over the country. And the bottom line is, this is a lawyerly answer, it depends. Very often, the default rule is we want to look at wherever the client is domiciled. If they live in a particular state, we want to explore, is that state going to work? Is it friendly? And where we can, that's actually what I prefer. But very often, the state where the client is domiciled is not the best. And so we go shopping, and there are a number of states which are better than others. Sometimes it's not just the state that they live in, but also what they're doing. I recently encountered a situation where, because of the nature of the assets, it determined, and they were frankly oil and gas assets, it determined both the jurisdiction, the domicile in which we form the entity, but also the type of entity that we form because of some local tax consequences for that particular asset. So it depends. We have to look at it, and we're going to look at the local tax rules, the filing requirements, the creditor remedies that are available, and the operating issues and the domicile of the parties involved, and we will come up with an answer. That's an answer that has to be addressed by the advisory team to determine what state is best.
And I would say, you know, sometimes, and I've had clients actually say this to me, that there's a suspicion that we're setting them up in a particular place to generate, you know, additional work or fees. And I just want to assure everyone that for the work that we do, that never comes into the equation. Our preference would be to set it up where it's absolutely the easiest and the most efficient for all of us. But that being said, we're not going to sacrifice the asset protection features that we can garner by being in a particular state or in a particular jurisdiction. So I just want to throw that out there so that those who are listening and our clients who listen understand that our preference would be for it to be in your state, you know, and just be as absolutely as easy as possible. But frankly, some states just don't offer the protection that one should have after going through this whole process. And when all your assets are tied up in a family bank, we're gonna find the best place with the best laws to take care of your assets that we can possibly find.
You know, those fees typically go to third parties, not us. They go to a local registered agent, and frankly, these are a loss leader. The time it takes to do the paperwork annually with some of these entities is significant, but the fees that we can charge are trivial. So, yeah, I would rather not have to handle annual reports for some of these entities, but we do it because we're taking care of our clients. It's not a huge moneymaker. You know, the next issue that kind of plays into this, where do we form it, is who are the owners? And there's some significant legal issues here that have to be addressed in the ownership. And first off, the family bank, for it to be effective, must be a multi-member or a multi-partner entity. It can't even qualify as a partnership under tax law if it doesn't have more than one partner. So it's got to have more than one partner. And then a huge, huge thing is we are not going to have any of those members or partners be natural persons. This is one of the huge flaws of the old family limited partnership model, which was just deeply, deeply flawed and had so many hazards that it caused enormous problems. Natural people, they die, they get sick, they become incapacitated, they get divorced, they get sued, they're mortal, they do not have superpowers, contrary to what the comic books and the movies want to tell us. And so we don't want natural persons to be involved. And historically, frankly, the death of a partner resulted in the automatic termination of a partnership, and which causes problems in the big issue. But trusts don't die. So we want, among these multi-members or multi-partners, we want them to be the trusts. And typically, it's going to be a partnership between the revocable trust and the irrevocable dynasty trust. Typically, that irrevocable dynasty trust is going to be grantor defective. So it's going to be taxed to the grantor. And what all that means is it's going to be tax neutral, number one, and number two. Let me elaborate on number one. It's not the tax liability from the structure from before you had it to after you implement it. Your tax liability is not going to go up, but it's not going to go down. It's going to stay the same. It's going to be tax neutral. But then the other thing is the taxes are typically going to flow through to the grantor, to mommy and daddy who set this thing up. They're going to pay all the taxes on the family bank, even though they may not own all the family bank because part of it is owned by the children or the grandchildren through a dynasty trust. And then I guess on the ownership question, another issue we often have to deal with is, should the management company be an owner? And this is confusing to a lot of people. Yesterday I was dealing with this with a client. He thought in his mind, well, the management company manages, so it owns, right? And no, the answer is no, 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 no. Remember, we're separating risk and control and equity into three different buckets, and this is the equity bucket. So we don't grab a hold of the handle of the equity bucket and dump it into the management, the control bucket, because that's where risk resides. So the management company should not be an owner generally, but with this one qualification. If the family bank is a limited partnership, then we cause the management company to own a very small interest as the general partner. And that's how we manage the risk that flows out of the general partnership, by causing it to go into the risk bucket, which is the management company. So generally, unless it's a limited partnership, the management company does not own it. If it does own anything, it's a very small amount as a general partner. And sometimes in situations where there are not enough people or not enough entities, there's always exceptions to this rule, but that's something that we have to address with fact-specific planning in each individual case.
Well, Rick, I think it would be a good time for us to go to break. And pick this up, since we're starting into a new section after the break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about control and a few other things as we wrap this show up on the family bank.
From the boardroom to you. Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back. This is Rick Durfee. I'm the lawyer.
And this is Rich Bloomfield, and I'm the CPA.
And this is What About Wealth, and we're having a good time today talking about fun with the family bank. And we have been talking about where it should be formed and who should own it, and we're now going to talk about who should control it. Because remember, the family bank, its function is to hold the equity separate from control. So where do we place the control? That's our question. And the answer is, or the mechanism for manipulating the control is slightly different between the LP and the LLC. With the LP, control follows the general partner. With the LLC, control is vested, quote unquote, in a manager. So typically, if we have the ideal situation, we want to place control of the family bank in the management company. You know, we've talked about the management company on other programs, some technical nuances to this. For asset protection and estate planning purposes, we actually want more than one manager if it's an LLC. So we will cause the management company to be one of the managers, and then we will have one of the trusts typically be the other manager. And which trust we use depends upon how concerned the client is and what risk factors we're trying to address for purposes of asset protection. If we have a high-risk client with lots and lots of asset protection issues, we will cause that second manager to be the irrevocable Dynasty Trust. But if it's a pretty low-risk situation, we have very minimal risk factors. A driving motivator is not necessarily asset protection. It's a nice benefit, but that's not what's motivating the client to come in and take action. Then we can explore having maybe the revocable trust be the other manager. But typically that's where we're going to place control. And as we talked about earlier, that allows us to pay management fees to that management company, which is a tax planning device, among other things. So we can cause where some of the income accumulated or earned by the family bank is ultimately taxed.
All right. So, Rick, I already have an LLC. Can I just use that as my family bank? I've heard that 100 times.
Yeah.
Tell us what we should do with that.
The answer is, yeah, maybe, but there can be some significant benefits from converting an existing entity into the family bank, but we have to do it correctly. And there's a huge difference between the family bank we're describing and the typical LLC that people have set up on their own, or often even with the help of a lawyer. With a family bank, we just can't have a single member LLC or a member managed LLC. It has to be multi-member manager managed, and we want those members and the managers not to be natural persons. And so all of those are things that typically with the I already have an LLC, we've got to go in and fix if we're going to use that. And then we have to, of course, have the documentation that we talked about earlier, either the operating agreement or the partnership agreement, because if we don't have that, the entity will fail at its essential purpose. So all the documentation that we talked about. Now, when, let me talk to you some real life situations where, because we had an existing entity that we converted into a family bank in an asset protection situation, that is actually really beautiful. Because often one of the issues we have to address and plan around so that we avoid stepping on the landmine is we want to absolutely vigorously avoid what's called a fraudulent conveyance, where we have transferred assets for the sole purpose of defrauding creditors from their rightful claims. And sometimes when we're establishing a new entity and then we have a liability event occur shortly thereafter, the allegation is made that, well, you just set that up to not pay me for this liability. But when we have an existing entity that has matured, it has some time under it, its asset protection improves with age. So we want to take that entity and use it, but we're going to improve it. We're going to upgrade it. We're going to often add the documentation that they didn't do in the first place. We're going to change who the owners are and who the members are and who the managers are. So, but now we have a historical entity that's been here all along functions in that purpose. So we can use an existing entity, but almost never can we use it as is.
All right. So I know we don't. We always run out of time before we run out of material here. But so the family bank versus the family limited partnership. What we need to talk about what the difference is between those really quickly.
Yeah, back in the 80s and 90s, we saw tons of these family limited partnerships, and they would have often no business purpose, and they would have natural persons being the partners, and all of which resulted in huge problems. They were challenged by the IRS because, you know, what's the purpose for doing that? It's not a real partnership. It's a sham partnership. And natural people then, again, get divorced, die, and have medical issues and create all kinds of problems. So the family bank, we avoid all those issues by requiring it from the get-go to have non-tax business purposes, and it is never owned by natural persons. It's owned by these trusts and other entities. So it's a very distinct entity from the classic family limited partnership that we saw in the bank. Now, Rich, an issue that we get asked all the time, and that this is one of the areas where you end up playing a vital role, is, okay, we've set this dumb thing up. The lawyers did this to me. What do I do with it? And they will come to you to complain about what the lawyer did. How do I operate this thing? How do I start it up? And that's an area where you are often holding the client's hand and helping them through that. Why don't you talk us through some of those issues on implementation and using the family bank?
Okay, so this is an area where I end up doing a lot of work, or my staff, in, you know, we've talked about this on shows before, Rick, but overall, this is the place where attorneys end up getting complained about the most, because they do the documentation, they set up the whole thing, and even if they did a great job at that, they hand the client the documents and say, okay, great, it's done. And very often there is no follow through on actually implementing and funding the entities that they've set up. So you know, in a huge percentage of the time, what happens is that these documents just get put on the shelf. The funding doesn't happen, and when somebody dies, then everything, all the work that was done, really amounts to nothing, and we didn't accomplish anything. So this is a very critical area, and you know, generally, once we've gone through and set these up, we do have a tax ID number. We've got, you know, the articles of organization. We've got the operating agreements. We've got everything that we need. It's just that you have to take some action. And one of the biggest things to do is that you need to set up a bank account. And many of my family banks have multiple bank accounts or brokerage accounts, Rick. And so it's not just setting up one, but it's getting If you have existing brokerage accounts where you are holding stocks or bonds or other things, those need to be transferred to the family bank. And this is not often not a easy process because brokerage houses, you know, still require, I don't know whether it's the regulation or just their own particular nuances, but they want a level of documentation that is just amazing in today's world. Documents that are signed in blue ink and, you can't fax them over or scan them over. You have to mail them. So sometimes it takes a while, but we can get all the accounts moved to the bank account set up. We make sure that we understand who the manager is. The manager has to be the one that sets up the bank account and is the signer on the bank account or on the brokerage accounts. And in addition to that, because this is a family bank, it very often has other subsidiary LLCs, or in other words, other LLCs that it owns or owns a percentage of. We have to make sure that that all happens, and that when we start making distributions or issuing K-1s or whatever it is, that all those people are, all that activity is included, or that, and that the K-1s that we issue are getting issued to the proper entities, whether that's the two trusts or whatever it turns out to be in a particular situation. So setting up the bank accounts, making sure money is moved in, filing the tax returns correctly, those are all part of implementation that makes this whole thing work. And if you don't do this part, then pretty much you wasted your time and money on the rest of it. So,
which is really sad. I always say to the client, look, for this to work, for you to get the value of your investment, you have to do what you say you're going to do. So we form these, and the client, often we get the deer in the headlights. I have to transfer my brokerage accounts. Yes, you have to do that. And we actually will help them do that, but we can't do it for them because there's paperwork that they have to sign and they have to request and ask for. But having your side, the accounting side on the team, helping the client understand it and work through that is valuable beyond words. I just cannot express how important that is and how much better the outcome is when the clients have actually done this part of the deal.
All right. So we need to talk about how do we use the family bank once we have one. So because that, again, is another perplexing thing to a lot of people. So you get a bank account set up, you move the brokerage accounts in, they start earning money. They might have ancillary LLCs that are owned by the family bank that are making money. So money is flowing in. What do they do with it? Who can use it? How should they use it? Who can spend it? Those are all questions. And so we make sure that that we have a good set of books. And so very often we're setting up QuickBooks or some other accounting software for our clients so that all the activity that's happening in the family bank is accounted for. So when we go to do tax returns, we actually have good books and records to do them from. And I've been down the road where there weren't any, and that's a nightmare. So we really make a big effort to get those books set up right away. The other thing that we should point out about the family bank is that it typically has no employees. We don't want employees in the family bank where all the assets are, because employees can sue you. They can get upset for wrongful dismissal or sexual harassment or who knows what. And so we typically try to put the employees in the management company or with a service company or a subsidiary, and then those employees are effectively leased. If the family bank needs someone to do something, then those are leased from the management company, or the management company just handles anything that needs to be done and a management fee is paid to them. we also have to, you know, there will be professional fees that need to be paid for annual tax returns or accounting, or annually we like to take a look at the family bank, make sure everything's in order from a legal standpoint. And I think maybe we talked about this earlier, Rick, but the assets that are owned by this entity, just in general, all excess cash and non-qualified. In other words, no, you can't own your IRA or your 401k in this entity. That has to be owned by you individually. But all your excess cash and non-qualified investment accounts are owned in here. And then, you know, if you've got other real estate assets, those would probably be owned by a separate LLC, but that LLC would be majority owned by this entity. You don't put vehicles in here. You don't put dangerous toys in here, Rick. That's not where you put them. You put those somewhere else.
Yeah, that's, I wanted to mention that. Thank you. That we don't want to put things that explode, blow up, hurt people, cause danger, because that's bringing the danger into this equity bucket where it's going to hurt something that we care about. Another critical thing there that I see a lot. I've actually had this happen recently where a client was buying personal groceries and actually had some awkward things, purchases at Victoria's Secret out of their limited partnership that then they went and filed personal bankruptcy, and now those purchases are being discussed in the courtroom. You know, what was this? So you don't do personal stuff in that limited partnership if you want it to, or that LLC if you want it to happen. Have its asset protection function. So hopefully this has helped you with the family bank. We've talked through its use and implementation. It's a fun thing. Come visit us. Email us. Call us at 480-324-8000. Email us at info@whataboutwealth.com. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll be back again next week.
Thank you for listening to What About Wealth with hosts Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. Please join us again for another edition next Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a profitable week.